else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And I'm always at a bit of a loss at this point.
No, we just go home. See, that's all we have to do.
We've said our names harmoniously in unison.
Well, I would say sort of in unison, mildly harmonious.
Could be. Anyway.
But for us, that's spectacular.
It is. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only the name of this riveting, exciting, and, I don't know, something else radio program. It's also the name of a SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas.
Yes.
And the SEC, we're registered with the SEC, which means they're our regulator, which means that we're, quote, a large investment advisory firm as opposed to a small investment advisory firm. They're typically registered with the states. And that doesn't mean that they approve or disapprove of it. It just means that's who our regulator is.
They don't approve or disapprove of anything, Senator.
They disapprove of most everything.
Yeah, their stance, their job. And it's, I mean, I guess that's what you want in a regulatory authority. Just tell people not to do things that might be dangerous.
Just not to do things.
Yeah, don't do stuff.
Except the stuff that we want you to do, and then you'll do a lot of that.
Yeah.
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 And let's see, what else do we need to say? We don't pay for this radio program.
That is correct.
And they don't pay us to do the radio program, KTEM. We do advertise on KTEM for the radio program, and that's...
But so do they.
So do they. Yeah, they do. Both we and they advertise for the radio program on KTEM.
Right.
Now, that's full disclosure if ever I heard it.
And people can be going, wait a minute, where's the quid pro quo? Why? Because we started doing this radio program a long time ago.
Back before the hills got dusty.
People seem to appreciate it. That's the reason why.
Every year when the renewal of the program comes up, we look at each other and said, why are we doing this again?
And the staff goes, you need to keep doing it. People like your program. And so, we go...
Yeah, but okay. Saturday morning,
though.
Blown away. The information we present on this radio program is not investment advice.
It's educational.
Even though that we are the principals of an investment advisory organization.
I just called it educational. That's like execution and education combined.
I think that's like alternative school. You're not supposed to do any executing.
It's educational. Listen to this and you will be educated.
It is educational in nature, and investment advice is given based on a person's individual goals, objectives, risk tolerances, and a whole bunch of other stuff. Stuff being the technical term that we use there.
Yes, it's you can find it in any economics textbook.
That's right. And there's probably something else that I'm supposed to disclose, but I can't remember what it is. I think we got it.
Yeah.
We should have a little script we read. I can read it really fast, and nobody would understand.
You didn't say
anything.
Deem, did you?
No. That's the one
reliable.
I left out. Yes.
We have to deem. If we're not deeming, what are we doing?
The information we present on this radio program is from sources we deem to be reliable.
Yeah, we deemed it.
See, good.
Nice.
But isn't warranted or guaranteed to be complete or truth or factual.
Well, why don't you just say guaranteed or guaranteed? You can use another name for it too, like warranty or guarantee, but they basically are the same. So
It's deemed reliable, but not warranted or guaranteed to be complete or without error.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes.
But we do a really good job of chasing stuff down. And
yeah.
Getting
we do try
sources.
To verify as much as we can.
Well, the stock market did a really good job this week. If you like the stock market that goes up, it went up the Standard & Poor's 500 went up 0.94%, closed at 3265.35 if you're keeping up with these things. The big number that was momentarily crossed and then the Dow Jones Industrial Average retreated was 29,000. We like those round numbers. I suspect unless something goes terribly wrong in the near future, just for the fun of it, the market will rise to beat the 29,000 mark probably next week. Why did the market decline at the end of the week? And I read lots of opinions as why the market declined on Friday after crossing 29,000. And the answer is, I think, because the Dow crossed 29,000.
Yeah.
A lot of people
thought, round number.
It's 29,000, I'm going to sell. So people started selling.
People put their little trade orders in advance, and they say stuff like, well, yeah, this will take a while. If it ever gets to 29,000, I'm going to sell. And for some reason, round numbers are important to humans. This is a very strange thing. And
well, it's because we have 10 digits on the top and 10 digits on the bottom. And either way, we wind up with a round number.
Right. So the difference between a 9 and a 10 is everybody likes a 10. Or the difference between a 10 or 11. Well, the 10 is a round number, so it can make a headline out of a 10. You can't make a headline out of an 11.
The difference between a 9 and a 10 is in fingers is pretty painful.
I can just see that you're
losing a finger.
Yeah, you have made a point. So did you see what I did there?
Yep.
I made a point.
A digital point.
Ha! Index it. Why don't you?
Well, so the... And the interesting thing is, way back in 2003, there was a guy who wrote a book. It's different this time. Dow 30,000.
Yeah. It was almost there.
And a guy, and it's only like 3.5% rise, and it'll get to 30,000. And the guy who wrote that, although predicted in 2008 is when it would cross, he wrote that in 2003, and it said in 2008 it'll cross 30,000.
You may have been a little optimistic.
A little bit. The market was in a free fall at the time he said that. And the 30,000 Dow is something that John Templeton predicted, and a lot of people predicted who were visionaries. I shouldn't say a lot. A few people predicted way back when. He predicted 10,000, and he... And the market has continued to rise. And one of the things that's pretty consistent, of all of the asset classes one could invest in, if you were just took the median or average of the asset classes you can invest in, whether it be real estate or whatever, there are certainly exceptions for individuals. But securities, meaning stocks, traded in the United States of America over the long term have had, to the best of my knowledge, the highest long-term return. And I know that sounds really dumb and mundane, but the point is people are continually coming up with alternative investments and better ways and buy gold or buy this other thing over here and do this commodity switch and whatever. But if you're patient over the long period, so far, when we look at the asset classes, the various places you could have invested your money 30 years ago or 20 years ago or 40 years ago, corporate America, free enterprise corporate America, has had the greatest success rate of any place you could go. Now, I will make a caveat here and tell you, you could have invested in emerging markets 42 years ago and you'd be ahead of the you'd be ahead of the S&P 500, but you would have had to suffer through 20 years of loss, which kind of, in my opinion, takes it out of the running. 20 years of severe loss in that index. So that's a thing to remember. Don't get enticed away. And there's a tendency to be enticed away into exotic whatevers, alternative investments, particularly when euphoria begins to set in the market. And we have in... I went back and counted the articles with the word, I saw the word euphoria 5 times in different articles in Wall Street Journal this week. And euphoria is the end of a bull market. When it's going to end, nobody knows. There's no way of telling. The economic information, the economic data out there, the jobs report came out. We're going like gangbusters. Manufacturing continues to lose jobs. Services, leisure, healthcare continues to gain jobs. We're at full employment, then we're at fuller employment, then we're at more fuller employment.
Fullest isn't maybe possible, but we're fullest that has ever happened.
And I remember this same situation. Now, I was unable to go back and find the data because, amazingly, the Commerce Department and the Labor Department, everybody else, weren't gathering data in the detail that we see today back in 1999.
Yeah.
But I remember back in 1999, fund managers, people who run mutual funds, who made speeches in those conferences that we attended, who said this below 4% unemployment rate is being cited as reason that the bull market and the economy should continue to roar. And they're saying, no, it isn't. It means we're at the end of this because we've been adding jobs so fast, we can't keep adding jobs this fast. It's just not possible to grow the way we've been growing. And once we stop growing,
it's not possible
we go the other way.
To sustain that growth. Yeah, it's possible to get the growth that we've gotten,
but to keep it on forever, it isn't going to happen.
Yeah, it's that's just a truism. You can't grow more than your ability to grow.
And I remember at the time, famous fund managers, Tom Bailey, who managed Janus Fund and his compatriots, saying that in 1999, you really need to hold on to your hat because this has been too good for too long. And I think that's where we are today. Now, does that mean you should bail out and run for the woods or something? No, that doesn't work. And the reason I say it doesn't work is because nobody's ever been able to pull it off successfully over a long period of time. They always wind up getting their timing off and losing anything they might have made and more. But let's enjoy it while it's here, at least. But make sure you keep some dry powder because despite the fact that I think we're now, by the way, I went through the, you probably had the same experience. I went through the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, The Economist, and a couple of other sites, and could find practically no skepticism or pessimism anywhere.
And anecdotally, in our client population, I've noticed the same thing. We had a lot of skeptics and pessimists just a couple of months ago. For some reason, and maybe it's end-of-year reports with just glowingly large returns, people just are assuming this is going to keep going. And I'm happy for the returns, don't get me wrong. Obviously, I'm happy for the returns. But this is the time when you get the really good returns. This is the time that you warn people bad returns exist. And when really bad returns are happening, that's the time that you tell people good returns exist. You've got to keep the balance.
It's kind of like living in Puerto Rico. If we had 6 weeks ago or a few weeks ago said to people in Puerto Rico, you know you're living in a high earthquake zone. And they would say, oh, but we haven't had a severe earthquake in, what, 50 years?
Yeah, it's fine. It's fine. And now they've had multiple. And they might look at it differently. We're really good at responding to catastrophe, to making changes in our lives based on big traumatic events. But it's a lot healthier long term to pre-do the changes before the traumatic event. It's kind of like wearing a seatbelt. I mean, and this is something I ask most people that I meet, and we get to this point of a conversation, and I say, how often has a seatbelt saved your life? And the vast majority of people will answer that a seatbelt has never saved their life. And I say, well, is it a good idea to wear a seatbelt? And they say, yes. So this is pre-education. This is stuff that the majority of people do wear seatbelts because they realize that this is safety. Most people have never had a seatbelt save their life, but at some point, people gathered the knowledge either through defensive driving or fear of tickets or something that caused them to make a good decision, even in places where it's not illegal to drive without your seatbelt on. Most people wear a seatbelt.
So basically, your portfolio should have a seatbelt in it.
Yeah, exactly. And most people don't know that they can have a seatbelt in their portfolio. And the seatbelt isn't designed to make your portfolio go faster.
No, it slows it down.
It does. And that's the whole idea, is that sometimes you've got to put a little bit of resistance against growth so that you don't ungrow faster than you grew.
Jake has said this on many occasions. I'm going to quote it again from Sir John Templeton. Bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. And we went from skepticism last year
To definitely into optimism.
I think we may have even slipped right on past optimism.
Into euphoria? I wouldn't be too surprised if we get some euphoria coming up, but I still see enough headlines with when could the next drop hit. And when those headlines go away, we've definitely hit euphoria. Those headlines are fewer. They are definitely farther between. Just a few months ago, they were on every market headline you had, when's the end? Even if it was talking about how great things were, the question is, when will the drop come? Something like that is added to the end of the statement. Now those things are starting to fall off.
Over the long term.
That's a bad news. That's just as a side note. That's bad news for the market, because the more optimistic people are, the more people have already bought. That's fewer people left to buy, which means if everyone has already bought because they all agree this is going well, then all it takes is one seller, and there's no buyer there anymore. Everybody's already bought. So the price drops.
Now, we don't know what the earnings are for the fourth quarter yet. We did have some early reports come in where people's quarter ended on odd dates, like in November, so we can see what's going on. But the estimates by the consensus of estimates by analysts on Wall Street is that for the year 2019, earnings for the Standard & Poor's 500, the 500 companies that make up that index, dropped 0.2%. And yet the market was up over 28% for the year. That to me is an indication that the market has somehow departed from reality. Now, the market is assuming for some reason, and I've seen the estimates from various sites, that in the fourth quarter of 2020, there will be an earnings surge. Now, why they think, I've dug deep to try to figure out why the analysts think there'll be an earnings surge in the fourth quarter of 2020. Maybe it's far enough away that they can retire before it comes. I don't know. But the only thing I can think of is there seems to be a general optimism that there will be some magical phase two of the trade deal pass and trade with China will resume and go back to normal and all the tariffs will go away sometime in 2020, which, by the way, I don't think is going to happen.
No, I don't either. It might. There's predictability is not something that's often stated in the same sentence as President Trump. So I've just bucked that trend, and I've got predictability and President Trump in the same sentence. It makes him a savvy negotiator, but it's really hard to make predictions. So having said that, he really loves tariffs. He likes them a lot.
He calls himself Tariff Man.
Yeah, and when he is shown the limits of his power by Congress, usually in a relatively rude way, there are some areas where he has no limit to his power, and that's in the trade tariff area. The past Congresses have given the president the right to do what he's doing, and if he believes that that's the right thing to do, he's going to keep doing it. So will he stop? We'd have to have a pretty clear and well-designed trade deal with everybody involved for us to have the tariffs go away, I think. And there's no real evidence of that happening.
No, I think probably the status quo from phase one will continue in place. The president said that the next phase may very well be after the election.
Yeah, and I tend to think that's a likely event. Now, if it
happens at all.
Right. This is something that I think is important to mention here. Trade is not a huge portion of our economy.
It's about 12%.
Right. At 12%, having a pinch on trade, that's affecting our balance of trade a little bit. It's affecting the amount of trade that's going in and out. But it's affecting it at about 10% of the 12%. So we're down to about a 1.2% differential of what's actually happening in the world. And there's a lot of attention being put on that 1.2%.
That 12%, though, is a little misleading because there's other parts of the economy that aren't credited to import.
Correct.
And export. For
right.
example, the fact that we're having much, much lower imports from China than we've had in the past,
mm-hmm.
and we have less exports to China, is having a dramatic effect on the trucking industry. There have
yeah.
been several hundred, I think, and I'm pretty sure this is the right number, I think 600 trucking companies, including some major ones, who have gone bankrupt this year, and they're kind of falling like flies because the demand for transportation fell off. And there's an old theory to do with the Dow, the various indices of the Dow. One of them is transportation. And the part of the Dow theory is that the transportation index leads everything else, and transportation is down across the board. The stocks in the transportation
right.
index are down.
The American Trucking Association truck tonnage index fell 3.5% in November. That's 2.1% less than the year before. So it's down month to month and year to year. And that we don't have December's numbers in yet for trucking tonnage, but that says something to me very clearly. We're shipping less stuff around, and that includes with Amazon. Amazon is part of that.
And despite the fact that the number of shipments from Amazon has gone up dramatically. The total tonnage has dropped across the board in the United States. And that's one of those indicators. We may see that retail sales are up, and they are. We may see that a lot of things are going on that are positive. But then you get these counter signals. And the counter signals are worth paying attention to. When we get the fact that there's less tonnage being delivered and transported around the United States by trucking companies, while at the same time more stuff is being bought and sold, you really have to question if there's a mismeasurement someplace in the system.
Right. When we're looking back at from December, there's some data that came out for the third quarter of 2019. And what it said is that the turnover rate in the trucking world was at a relatively high level. What does that mean? What is turnover rate? That, well, you know those pastries? The turnover? No,
I
that's
thought it was
not
when
those.
An 18-wheeler flips over.
No, not those either. What it is when employment shifts. And in the third quarter, it was higher, and the fourth quarter is expected to be even higher than the third quarter. It was high because the large trucking firms laid off a lot of people in the third quarter. The small trucking firms hired a lot of people in the third quarter. That causes a high turnover rate. Coming into the third quarter, we know that there are a lot of bankruptcies that occurred in
fourth quarter.
Yes, into the fourth quarter of 2019. We know a lot of bankruptcies occurred. We know that bankruptcies occur when profits are down and expenses are up. And so what that means across the trucking world is that trucking is not import-export. It's generally inside the United States, but that facet of the economy is completely linked to import and export. As stuff comes in, it changes how things flow around, but that's not the only thing. Manufacturing is a big part of the reason why trucking was down. A lot of the tonnage in trucking isn't retail stuff. It isn't stuff that you're ordering from Amazon. That's a large amount, but if you consider one industrial bit of equipment, that's going to be a whole truckload versus the razor blades that you bought on Amazon last week. Even though they're in a box that is the size of your torso to hold one razor in it, it's still not a lot of tonnage. And that's the point, is that the manufacturing takes up a much larger percentage of trucking than normal shipping that you and I would receive at our doorstep. And that being said, manufacturing's down. Retail is up. Amazon's selling more stuff. But that's not going to make up the difference for the truck drivers. And that says something there, that we're at a mature point in the economy already. But with the trade pinch, it affects other areas of the economy. It's a small part of our economy doing trade. And the fluctuation in that trade is an even smaller part of the economy. But it percolates through everything. So you get a flavor of it in everything. And this is something that I point out. In the Great Recession, are you familiar with the top foreclosure rate during the Great Recession? It was horrible. Do you remember what it was?
No, well, it was pretty low.
1%.
Yeah.
And that was 1% of new loans. But it percolated through everything. Part of the reason why we had the Great Recession wasn't the foreclosures. Foreclosures are bad. People don't like it when people default on mortgages, particularly if you're an investor in the mortgage world. What caused the recession was the panic over which ones were failing, because nobody could tell where they were in their investments. Nobody could tell if this house in Florida, who owns it? The robo-signature folks out there, when they got into trouble at the banks for having a robot sign their foreclosure paperwork. The reason was because nobody knew who owned the mortgage. It had been split up so many times across so many different places. Let me kind of give you step by step on that. You buy a house. You say, it's going to be my primary residence. Only it's your third one and you're hoping to flip it. And this was very normal in Florida, in the build up to the recession. So you have fibbed on the mortgage application saying it's your primary residence. The mortgage broker fibbed, saying, yeah, I believe it, handed it off to a bank who didn't research to make sure what you said was correct. So everybody's culpable here. Everybody's made a mistake. And the mistakes are mostly purposefully done at this point. Then that mortgage company turns and sells this product, this loan that they just gave you. You owe them money. They're going to sell the rights to that loan to a big investment bank. That big investment bank takes that loan and dumps it in a huge pot, if you will. I'm mixing metaphors on purpose. This massive pot of mortgages. And then splits up the pot. Just scoops, ladles out. That means portions of that mortgage are added to lots and lots of packages that are handed out. And that's to spread the risk. The idea is to make the risk spread, and therefore nobody has any risk if we spread it all around. That was not proven to be correct, but that was the idea at the time. So 1% percolated through all the mortgage world. Go ahead.
The telephone number in here has changed.
Yes. Hopefully it won't be permanent.
If you want to give us a call, and presuming that today is the 11th of January where you are.
It is where I am.
The telephone number to call is 254-771-2463. That's 254-771-2463.
Yeah.
Apparently somebody turned off the 1400 line. Oh, here we go.
Oh, we got a call. They've been waiting for us. Caller on 771-2463. You are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead. Maybe. Caller. Nope. Not there. Okay.
It didn't
we'll
make
any
noise it normally makes.
Yeah.
When you come up there, it didn't start sounding fuzzy.
No, I don't think there was anybody there when I actually hit the switch to pick it up. So if you called, you can call back, and we will put you on the air. Hopefully that will work.
Once more under the breach.
Here we go. Caller on 773. I'm saying it again.
Still ringing.
This is line one.
771-2463. We'll try line one and see what happens.
All right. Caller on 771-2463. You're on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Okay, guys, enjoy the show. I have a question. Got a lot of talk recently about marked bills, and I don't want to relitigate the political aspect, but what's the deal with marked bills or unmarked bills? I thought all U.S. currency had serial numbers and those metal strips embedded in them. I'll hang up the messenger.
All right. Okay. Marked bills are a reference to an ink that can be exploded or put on money, and it's usually invisible to the naked eye, but has a UV or some other type of special light that will cause it to fluoresce or glow. And the idea is that it takes a long time to read the serial numbers to see if it's a stolen dollar or stolen $100. But if a bank has a little pin in the back and they just shine it on your money and it suddenly has a big splotch on it, they know it came from a robbery. Marked money for catching kidnappers and finding people that have robbed banks is a pretty effective solution. In a bank, if there's a holdup, the robber hands the note or has the gun or whatever. Just as a side note, we're at historic low levels of armed physical robbery at banks, but at absolute high levels of robberies at bank just online. So the robberies at the bank from Jesse James and so on, that's not so normal anymore. Anyway, when that's happening, the note's passed. The teller then reaches into the drawer and hits a special switch or a button or pushes something, and it causes ink to get on the money. And sometimes it's visible ink, which is not good for the health of the teller. So they've moved quite often to an invisible ink that stains the money and fluoresces it when you shine a light on it. Yes, they're all marked. They all have serial numbers on them. But when was the last time you looked at a list of serial numbers and tried to compare the dollars in your pocket to that list of serial numbers? If you've ever done it, first off, I'm not sure if I should congratulate you or not for doing it. Seems like a large waste of time. But if you have done it, you know it takes a long time. So marking it with ink is shorter. It's quicker. And it sounds good when you're giving a ransom demand. I want this in small, unmarked bills in a brown paper bag with an Elmo sticker on the front. That sort of thing. Just sounds more dramatic, I think. What do you think? Was that a good answer?
That was a good answer, and it's also used in the case where there's ransom money paid.
Yep. Like with an Elmo on it. Yeah.
Elmo on it. And it is, to give you some idea of why, it is an interesting point. And I don't know if this is still true, but several years ago I read this, that a sample of, I think, $1,100 bills was checked by the Treasury Department. And
they all had cocaine?
Every one of them had cocaine on them.
Yes, it's marked.
Literally every one
of them.
They're
just marked with different things, yeah. I'm not sure that's still the case because cocaine is not as popular as it once was, but it's still popular enough. I would not be surprised at all if $100 bills had cocaine on them still. Yikes. All right.
So the telephone number in here, if you'd like to give us a call, is 254-771-2463, and we'll figure out how to answer the phone.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I think we probably ought to figure out how to do some commercials.
Yeah, we'll do that real quick. We'll be back on the other side. Again, the number is 254-771-2463, and we'll be back on the other end of these commercials. Important words from our sponsors.
And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach with Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And cedar pollen season's upon us.
It is. It's and appalling.
Certainly welcome to give us a call.
It's appalling, appalling.
254-771-2463, and we have a telephone call now.
Yeah, caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Now, I have a follow-up question. In the recent Fortune magazine, they always have a round table at the beginning of the year. One of the supposedly talking heads that knows what's going on said that all the run-up that we've seen over the past 10 years were manufactured by companies either buying back shares to pump up their earnings per share growth or cost cutting. I love the ride we've been on. I'd like to hear your comments on their perspective on this. Thank you.
Sure. Okay.
I wouldn't say all, but I will say that since tax reform, since the last tax
act, since 2017, the end of 2017,
a lot of money came back from overseas, and
well, that wasn't what was intended.
They wasn't used to buy new equipment,
no,
and buy new factories, as was hoped. Because at the same time, the tariffs hit, and that produced uncertainty. So
instead, they bought back their own shares.
This is a result of the law of unintended consequences. Some, I don't remember, decades ago, in the 1990s. There was a law passed that limits the deductibility of executive compensation at a publicly traded corporation.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you see that so-and-so, the CEO of this corporation, got $16 million, they really didn't get $16 million.
No. A big chunk of that was in stock options some other kind of compensation.
They got $2 million, let's say, is pay, and $14 million in stock options. Well, that puts it, obviously, the intention there was
I'm got to cry a minute. He only got $2 million in pay.
Right. It's rough sometimes.
How did he buy his McDonald's Happy Meals?
And when he got – that puts the CEO and the chairman of the board and the highly paid executives on the same side as the shareholders. They want the price of the stock to go up. Well, the easiest way to get the price of the stock to go up is to buy stock.
Yeah.
So they go in.
And if you have extra cash on hand at a corporation and you just buy it back for the treasury, it causes each individual share to be worth more.
Right. And what happens is it's the law of supply and demand. If there's a lot of people buying stock, and in this case the treasury of the company is buying stock, the price of the stock goes up. And a big portion, certainly not all, but a big portion of the stock market rise in the last 2 years, 3 years, the last three, 2 to 3 years, 2.5 years. Let's see, 17, 18, 19, yeah, last 2 years has been from stock buybacks. And that is just, it isn't all of the run up by any stretch of the imagination. Right.
And the earnings estimates, consensus, we said this in the newsletter, consensus earning estimates for the whole of 2019 for the all the companies in the S&P 500 combined averaged, it's expected a shrinkage in earnings of 0.2%.
And yet the stock market went up 28% for the year.
And some of that was stock buybacks. Some of that was optimism based on maybe the trade issues will go away and we can see increased growth based on the tax cut.
And there was a very significant factor here, and it didn't occur until the last half of the year. Outflows from equity mutual funds were very substantial at the end of 2018. As the stock market went down, and then into 2019, the outflows from equity mutual funds were accelerating and they were snowballing. Stock buybacks then occurred because the prices of the stock of the various companies got low enough that the boards of directors said, we got all this extra cash, let's buy some stock because it's too cheap.
That'll make our shareholders happy. It'll make us happy too. This is a win-win.
And once the stock market gets a certain level of momentum and it starts going upward,
people buy because other people are buying, and which is, by the way, not necessarily a good idea.
This last quarter, the fourth quarter of this year, or last year, we saw the stock market begin to rise very significantly with no evidence of rising earnings. And that was the snowball effect on the upside. It was referred to in the Wall Street Journal and other places as FOMO, FOMO.
Yeah,
fear of missing out. And this is what's going on right now. And this is, by the way, the last thing that happens in a bull market. At the tail end of a bull market, and we've said this many, many times, it's like Wile E. Coyote is running along on top of the mesa, and he just keeps going,
And goes out over the edge.
The mesa has fallen off underneath him, but he doesn't know it.
Until he looks.
At some point, I can say, I can't tell you the future. The future is absolutely unknowable, which is why there's not a lot of good news in the papers. And all the sites we go to, there's not a lot of good information this time of year because everybody's trying to predict what's going to happen in 2020, which is foolish to say the least. But at some point, Wile E. Coyote will whip out his sign that is bigger than he is.
And that says yipe.
That says whoops.
Yeah, in his pocket. Yeah. And that analogy, that example is far better than a lot of people give it credit for. It sounds like it's just kind of a off-the-cuff cartoon analysis of what's going on, but the mesa that Wile E. Coyote's running on is created by us. And in essence, if we're all Wile E. Coyotes, we're the ones that with our minds are creating that mesa.
Irving Fisher said it best when he's talking about the mesa. Permanent plateau.
Yeah.
The permanent plateau of prosperity.
Yeah. So that running out there, that plateau. Okay, the economy, as much as it's measured in money, it's not about money, it's about people. And that is the biggest piece of truth in economics I can give anybody. It's about people. And when people are hiring, it's because people are buying. You don't hire people if you don't have a product that's selling or that you think will sell. So when people are buying, they're buying because they have jobs. And they have jobs because people are buying. So you see that loop. And momentum picks up there. I got a job because people are buying this product, and now I can go over and buy this product so somebody else might get a job. Eventually, everybody has enough of those products. It's not enough differential from the last product that they bought that the buying starts to slow down. This isn't some great catastrophe, although it's quite often written up in the headlines as a great catastrophe of the market cycle has shifted or the business cycle is matured and this is on the shrink. It's just a natural part of what you're not going to have 37 new computers in your living room unless you're stealing them.
To give you some idea what we're seeing that frankly makes us nervous, and I know we're we're at risk of becoming labeled permabears.
We were labeled permabulls during the recession, so I'm okay with being a permabear in the boom.
John Norman, the head of Cross. Now listen to what he's the head of. He's the head of Cross Asset Fundamental Strategy at J.P. Morgan.
Okay.
Announced nothing to derail big move up in risky markets.
That's a scary statement. When big names are saying things like that, it means that fear is not a component of what they're talking about. Preparation in planning, that they go hand in hand. I mean, go back to planning a camping trip. Well, you need to remember to bring salt and pepper. You need to bring your food. But if you bring the food and not the salt and pepper, you're going to regret it. You need to bring a tent. Well, why do you need a tent? Well, it might rain. Well, stop being such a pessimist. No, that's not being a pessimist. That's recognizing the reality of the world. Downturns happen. And if somebody ever said to me, it looks like from the trends that we're seeing recently that we're not going to have rain for the next 2.5 years, unless they're in Antarctica or the Sahara Desert, I'm going to have a lot of doubt about that because I've seen too many rainstorms.
Well, let me give
we're mixing a lot of metaphors here, but weather is a really good way of looking at this as well.
Deutsche Bank Wealth Management issued a report that says the Outlook 2020, the end of monetary magic, and their response to their own question is, no, it's not the end. This year will be wonderful. The stock market will rise all year.
That makes me nervous. I really, really like pessimistic headlines. And people say, what are you talking about? Because pessimistic headlines usually mean a good year in the market. People are optimistic when they're already invested, when they are less concerned about the bad things that always exist in any economy. Every economy has something wrong with it, no matter how good it is, no matter how beat up it is. There's always something wrong in the economy, whether it's logistical or demographic, how much money is concentrated in one area over another, how the flowing of money from one side of the economy to the other happens and trickles in between the right places. There's always something broken. It's true in a car, too. If you're driving a car, there's always something that could break at any moment. That doesn't mean it will, and normal maintenance helps that. But the longer you go between normal maintenance cycles, the more likely you're going to have something break, and that's where we are between recessions, if we just think of a recession as a maintenance cycle. And when everybody has to step back and fix the things that they've been working on instead of work at them nonstop. And I think if people approach the idea of recessions with that attitude, it helps a lot. It's still not fun. Recessions aren't fun, and we're not rooting for the next recession, but we also recognize that they're a fact of life.
The big economic news this week was the Labor Department, Bureau of Labor Statistics, which is one of my favorite places. I just wonder, it would really be wonderful to see all these people sitting around doing their thing. Anyway, the Bureau of Labor Statistics came out and said that the U.S. economy added 145,000 jobs in the month of December, and the unemployment rate remained at 3.5, mm-hmm. which is historically low. And that sounds really good. And you dig through it, and sure enough, there's 40,000 jobs added here and 40,000 jobs added there, and the manufacturing lost 12,000 jobs, and you go through this, and it looks really good until you realize, and this is where it's good to step back and take a look at this, and everybody received this information that I read saying, yay, this is really good. We were doing roughly twice that number of new jobs per month a year ago. So we are producing new jobs and hiring new people in the economy,
and
only at half the rate we were a year ago.
There's
and
another
it's been slowing down all year.
Another piece to throw in here is that the jobless rate was down over the year in 223 of 389 areas, the metro areas. So 389 minus 223 is 166 of those metro areas that experienced the opposite.
Right.
So 223 were up and 166 were down. That's getting really close to parity.
And the other thing is that you have to aware that we produce on average each month in the United States, and it varies from month to month, a big surge typically in June, 125,000 new potential employees that need to find a job. So any time that our job creation rate falls below 125,000, we're actually losing ground.
We just took the act of procreation and made it boring.
Yeah.
We need to ring some bells on that one. Say it again. Every month,
we produce. Well, now
125,000
people. This is graduating from
may
school.
Or may not need jobs.
These are people who graduate from school or from trade school or from wherever.
18 years removed from this act. This unboring act has been made boring. Thank you, dreary science.
Well, that's where we are.
That's economics.
So we only have right now a 20,000. Based on December's job production, we only have a 20,000. 20,000 is a blip in the size of the job market in the United States. We only have a 20,000 excess in there. The average for the last three months of last year was 138,000, which is even a finer roll over that 125,000. I don't know if Jake may agree with me or not, but I continue to think that there's a very high probability that 2020 will produce a recession. What's going to produce a recession?
I don't know.
But we've lost. It's kind of like anything else. The economy has lost momentum. The big thing that struck me in reading the details of the jobs report is unchanged. The percentages, as far as employment are concerned, there were more employees added here. There were 2,000 here. There were 4,000 there. There were 40,000 in a couple of years.
But the percentages are not changed from what they were last month or the month before.
So the percentages across the board and all the internal workings of the jobs report said nothing's changed. We're not growing. We're not really growing anymore. We're just holding our own. And as long as you have momentum on the upside, as long as you have a lot of room to grow and you've got growth going on as we did through last year, a steady growth in the economy and a steady growth in the workforce, then these things tend to feed on themselves, because when businesses hire somebody, they don't turn right around and lay them off, because they're putting an investment into them to train them.
Right.
And that's why jobs are a lagging indicator.
Yeah. And if you, this is something people can track. Go to BureauofLaborStatistics.gov, BLS.gov. I know we're sending you
exciting.
Bureaucratic institution.
One of my favorite websites.
Go to charts on there, because it'll be close to the top. And it'll start you at the civilian unemployment rate. And on that chart, you've got a couple of areas that are grayed out that are the recessions. And laid over the top of that is the civilian unemployment rate. And what you see is the unemployment rate starts to creep up a little bit right before a recession. And then it shoots all the way up to a really high rate at the end of the recession. Unemployment doesn't tell you when a recession's going to be. It tells you when it already happened. People get laid off and they say, is that saying that we're going into a recession? No, it means we were in the recession when they got laid off. That's generally what it means. And when we say it's a lagging indicator, people don't like to fire people. I don't care what business you're in, unless there's just a psychopath working there. People don't like to fire employees. I don't care if you've got a really militant company culture. It's still not fun to tell people they don't have a job anymore. You might cover it up and act like you're really tough if you're in that job, but it's traumatic. You're just severing people's professions, their careers, their income. People don't like to do it, so they put it off as long as they can. They're looking at the bottom line numbers of returns to the earnings and return on investment, and they look down and they say, hey, it's shrinking. We need to start cutting back. They only start cutting back after it's been shrinking for a little while, because most people say, hey, it's down this month, and they say, well, let's wait for a couple of months and see if that's a trend or if that's just a blip. And then at the end of those couple of months, they say, all right, we got to start cutting. We got to cut some people. Who do we need to cut? that's when it starts. When people get afraid for the long term value of the business, so they have to get rid of employees, it's already after profits are down. Lagging indicator. So what is another way that's a lagging indicator? People don't hire until profits are way up, or until they think profits are about to be way up. And we're about out of time. So that's it. That's employment across the board
for this hour.
Yeah. We're about out of time, so we're going to fire you all for at least 5 minutes for the news break.
Right.
Yes.
And you're welcome to give us a call next hour at 254-771-2463. That's 254-771-2463.
If you'd like to call us off the air, we have voicemail waiting locally at
254-947-1111.
All right, and you can reach that number toll-free at 1-800-914-7526.
That's a lot of numbers.
800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. We've got recordings of the radio program going back lots of years. We've got our newsletter up there and stuff about our philosophy, our made-for-radio faces, and our beautiful staff. So if you'd like to contact us through there, you can hit the contact form, or you can email us directly at jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth.